The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance, that's G-S-U-G-G-S Insurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. The issue from which I will read today is Time's September 13/September 2021 edition. As usual, it is bordered in red on the cover with a white inside border. The back of the main border here is all black, with Time in large block letters superimposed in a dark gray over that black background. The only photo on the cover is that of a dog tag, fingerprinted, hanging on a chain, with a young man in uniform pictured on it in rather shadowy shades of gray and white. The first article, then, is from the World heading, The Afghan Lessons, What the U.S. Can Learn from Our 20-Year War, by James Stavridis. The end was going to be painful. During the course of several administrations, the American public had grown tired of the war in Afghanistan and simply wanted it to end. The Biden administration decided to rip the bandage off, but unfortunately it ripped off a tourniquet, and we're watching the hemorrhaging of American honor and the death of the hopes and dreams of many Afghans, particularly many girls and women. How did we get to this point? Let me share my journey. Again, this is by James Stavridis, S-T-A-V-R-I-D-I-S. The war in Afghanistan began September 11, 2001. I was a freshly selected one-star admiral, the gold braid brand new on the sleeves of my service dress blue uniform. My office was on the outer E ring of the Pentagon, and through the windows across the corridor, I glimpsed a Boeing 757 just before it struck the building. The nose of American Airlines Flight 77 hit the first floor. I was about 150 feet away on the fourth floor and was spared. As flames and smoke engulfed the section of the Pentagon with my office, I stumbled down several flights of stairs out onto the grassy field below and tried to do what I could for the survivors and wounded until the first responders arrived. All I could think of was the irony of the day for me. After decades in the military, I had seen my share of combat, yet I was almost killed in what we all believed was one of the safest buildings in the world. Within weeks, I was placed in charge of the Navy's Deep Blue Innovation Cell, a small elite team charged with coming up with strategic ideas and tactical operations to leverage the capabilities of the Navy in what would become known as the Global War on Terror. After a year in that role, I was sent back to sea as a carrier strike group commander embarked in the nuclear carrier USS Enterprise, conducting operations on the Horn of Africa and in both Afghanistan and Iraq. Later, I would serve as senior military assistant to the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, and eventually become Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, with strategic responsibility for the war in Afghanistan. I was thus deeply engaged in what came to be known as the Forever Wars from their start in 2001 in Afghanistan, throughout the tragic misadventure in Iraq, till my retirement from the Navy as NATO commander in 2013. All the U.S. armed forces were profoundly changed by the experiences in both Afghanistan and the war in Iraq that followed. I've watched with great sadness the chaotic withdrawal of U.S. troops, diplomats, and civilians from Afghanistan and the fall of Kabul. What did it all mean, and what lessons should the U.S. military draw from this long conflict? More than 3,000 U.S. and allied dead, tens of thousands with significant wounds, and a few trillion dollars expended, to say nothing of hundreds of thousands of Afghans killed and wounded as well. In some ways, every war is a tragic waste of time, treasure, and most important, blood. But I believe the troops who fought in Afghanistan can hold their heads up with pride in one crucial way. We were sent to Afghanistan to find and bring to justice the 9/11 attackers, and more important, to prevent another attack on the U.S. homeland emanating from that ungoverned space. For 20 years we did that. Those troops stood on a wall on the other side of the world, defending our nation. And the gains in Afghanistan, part of our counterinsurgency strategic, are not insignificant. Millions of people can now read and write, many of them girls and women. Life expectancy has increased dramatically. Child mortality is significantly down. Access to information, tech startups, better infrastructure, and medical treatment are real, although much is at risk as the Taliban consolidate power. I signed 2,026 letters of condolence to the families of those killed under my NATO mission. Almost a third of the letters, by the way, were sent to European and other coalition families. To those families, I would say their loved ones fell in the service of a meaningful mission for their 50 different nations. But I would also now say we could have done better, lost fewer of them, spent far less treasure, and used some of the lessons from Vietnam and previous wars in Afghanistan. We could have done a better job of communicating our goals and aspirations to the people of our country and the people of the country in which we were fighting. We also could have done much better in marshaling and accounting for our resources and guarding against corruption and waste. We could have checked our hubris and optimism at the door. It was all quite reminiscent of the campaigns by their ancestors against the Soviets in the 20th century, the British in the 19th century, all the way back to Alexander the Great in ancient times. As in Vietnam, the U.S. forces were never defeated on the battlefield, but as a North Vietnamese officer pointed out to an American officer after the war there, that is true, but it is also irrelevant. All this is so predictable in hindsight, of course, so the central question becomes simple. What did we not learn from this history? The debates over who lost Afghanistan are just beginning. As was the case in Vietnam, there are plenty of suspects that will be debated endlessly. History will sort that out. But what interests me are the lessons we could and should take away. First, we must learn and understand the history, culture, and languages of any country in which we seek to intervene, be that militarily or economically. In Afghanistan, we failed to fully do so, and our hubris and arrogance did not serve us well. Fighting an insurgency is a long game indeed, and we did not heed the historical need for patience, the opposite of unwarranted self-confidence, and the endemic corruption on the part of the Afghan government at every level, was destabilizing. Second, constantly turning over forces hurts badly. The Army and Marines generally had tours of around a year in the country, the Navy normally 6 months, and the Air Force often less than that. Special forces would cycle in and out of country every few months. All that is understandable from a human perspective, but it hurts us badly in terms of continuity and expertise. Third, we did not efficiently adapt our technology to this new fight swiftly enough. It took us far too long to find solutions to the improvised explosive device challenge, improve satellite intelligence delivery to remote battlefields, procure simpler aviation systems that could be adapted to the rigors of Afghanistan, and create better communication systems among different national forces. In retrospect, we should have trained an Afghan fighting force that would have looked like the Taliban. Light, swift, less reliant on heavy logistics, high-tech intelligence, and air power. Lastly, we did not create the conditions on the home front that could have sustained a truly long-term effort. As casualties dropped while we withdrew the vast majority of troops under President Obama, the war in Afghanistan simply fell off the media and national radar. Across multiple administrations, we failed to communicate why our presence in Afghanistan was still useful and what benefit the U.S. and our allies derived from the expenditure of lives and treasure. The opportunity to bring all the troops home, touted as a campaign talking point by Trump, although about 90% of the 100,000 had long since returned, was a hollow but alluring call. Keeping a small footprint down to 2,500 by the time Biden took office would have made sense, but by then, political patience had expired. It is hard to construct a positive scenario. With luck, the future under Taliban 2.0 will be somewhat less apocalyptic than under the earlier edition, but we can't count on that. For years, the U.S. was somewhere between excessively optimistic and near delusional about what was possible to achieve. Sadly, Operation Enduring Freedom was neither enduring, nor did it deliver freedom for the Afghan people. It did buy two relatively terror-free decades in the U.S., but clearly we need to relearn the lessons of history and apply them in any future intervention, or we may again find failure awaiting us when we come to the end of our next major overseas engagement. Stavridis, a Time contributing editor, was the 16th Supreme Allied Commander at NATO, and is vice chair of global affairs at the Carlyle Group. There's a photo here. It looks gray with just a little bit of green dotting one edge. It's a landscape, a hill on one side, all tan and sandy, and it looks like a sandstorm blasting ahead because an IED explodes while Marines patrol in Helmand, Afghanistan in 2009. No one was killed, and indeed the Marines are in camouflage gear matching the sandy soil and heading either toward or away from that huge sandstorm funnel. Here's a full-page photo in oranges, shades of orange, bright orange, like the brightest sunset tier. Darker orange in the background. In the foreground, brownish orange in the shapes of large evergreen trees. A bit of glowing gold also in the foreground that appears to be reflecting off something metallic, like a generator or building of some kind. A light box, a state on fire. A chairlift. Oh, there's a chairlift off to the side with a cable attached going up, maybe a 35 or 40 degree angle from left to right across the photo. The chairlift, illuminated in a long exposure photograph, hangs empty as California's Caldor fire spreads through the Sierra at Tahoe Ski Resort August 29, 2 days before the blaze forced the first evacuation of South Lake Tahoe. The city would normally be buzzing with tourists, but by September 1, The fire destroyed over 660 structures and consumed some 190,000 acres. That is just a fraction of the 1.7 million California acres burned so far in this year's fire season, as hot and dry conditions made more likely by climate change make it easier for flames to spread. There is fire activity happening in California that we've never seen before, Tom Porter, chief of the state's Department of Forestry and Fire Protection, said August 31. For the rest of you in California, every acre can and will burn someday in this state. The photograph is by Noah Berger, AP. The Ground Zero death toll is still climbing, by Steve Buscemi, as told to Carl Vick. There are photographs here of firefighters approaching the collapsed World Trade Center, September 11, 2001. They're wearing black clothing around the garment's edges, and across the back of the jackets are gray and green stripes, possibly reflective. Some of them are wearing typical firefighter helmets, others are not. In contrast to that photo of Afghanistan where it just looked like a sand cloud, this looks like a concrete cloud. They're walking down a street, but it's all filled with gray concrete dust debris. There are buildings noticeable on either side. A traffic signal is green in the foreground, and that's noticeable, but further in the background, it's just a wall of concrete gray dust. And a small inset photo of a almost smiling young man standing by an FDNY red fire truck number 55. He's in a t-shirt, and it's the author on duty in the early 80s, and the author again is Steve Buscemi. My dad was a sanitation worker for New York City. His message to me and my brothers was, when you turn 18, take whatever civil service test is available. Lucky for me, it was the fire department's. I did not yet know what I wanted to do for a career, but at Engine 55 in Lower Manhattan, I found something even better, a brotherhood. I laid low as a probie, but by the time my Secret Other Life came out, I had taken acting classes and dabbled in stand-up. I understood that busting balls is how firefighters express affection. When, after 4 years on the job, it became impossible to juggle my shifts with both a movie and a play, I took a leave of absence, figuring I would be back. 17 years later, I was. One of the strongest sensations that flooded over me, September 11, 2001, was that feeling of connection. The next morning, I grabbed my old gear, got a lift to the site, and found a place on a bucket brigade. Instead of water going up, it was rubble coming down. Once in a while, a body bag was passed, though none weighed much at all. That was disturbing. The dust? It was more of a nuisance. Pulverized concrete and who knows what that clogged a face mask. So fast you worked better without one. Somebody would say, this is probably going to kill us in 20 years. Well, it didn't take 20 years. Debilitating chronic conditions surfaced before the pile was even cleared. Today, more people are thought to have died from toxic exposure at the 9/11 site than died that day. Bridget Gormley, whose father Billy died of cancer in 2015 after working at the WTC for 3 months, titled her documentary Dust, The Lingering Legacy of 9/11. It shows federal, state, and city officials trying to project strength by declaring the air around the towers safe. It was, of course, thick with carcinogens. As an expert in the film points out, wet cement splashed on human skin will begin to burn into it. But had the truth been shared with the firefighters, I am pretty sure they would have kept right on working. It actually felt good to be there. I was on the site for less than a week, but it was not till I got home that the magnitude of it all caught up with me. I was already seeing a therapist, and though it was almost impossible to process the enormity of what had happened, just having someone with whom to sit with all the feelings was a consolation. It is not something first responders usually get. Announcing vulnerability is a hard thing for anyone, but especially for people whose primary identity is as a protector. When in the fall of 2001, a New Yorker named Nancy Carbone went from firehouse to firehouse asking how she could help, one took her aside. "They're hurting," he said, "and they do not know how to talk about it. They do not know who to talk about it with." So, Nancy started Friends of Firefighters, providing free mental health counseling to the active and retired and their families. Funded by donations, it operates out of an old Brooklyn firehouse, familiar confines that offer comfort and a kitchen table to hang out around. It will be put to use for years, especially around anniversaries, with the power to trigger emotions. "Never forget," everyone said. "Some people have no choice." What is surprising is who has to be reminded. Shortly after the attack, Congress created a victim compensation fund to help first responders cope with the aftermath of the day. When the money began to run out, survivors had to launch a lobbying campaign to secure permanent funding, which finally came in 2019. It was an effort led by John Stewart and activist John Thiel, and backed by every former firefighter who cannot laugh without coughing, and every family member who pretends not to notice. Never forget, because people are still struggling. People are still dying. And that was as told to Carl Vick. Under politics, the Schumer method, how the Senate's great kibitzer became the key to the Biden agenda by Molly Ball. There's a full-page portrait on a facing page of the Senate Majority Leader in his office at the U.S. Capitol, August 4. This is a dark photo. The walls, I don't know whether they are actually painted in dark brown or simply remain unlit with the photograph. Schumer himself is kind of seated on the edge of a very large, dark brown colored desk. There are portraits in the background which appear to be, except again, they're almost shrouded by this darkness. They appear to be Franklin D. Roosevelt and Theodore Roosevelt. They're large, old portraits. A wall-hanging sconce, a floor lamp, a photo on a credenza behind this very large desk. Schumer himself, oh, there's a plant, too, off on the right, green plant. Schumer himself is almost halfway bathed in light, whether it's from a window or a photographer's lighting, it's not known. He is looking at the camera. He appears to be dressed in a dark blue suit. It's definitely dark. He has a American flag on his left lapel, glasses tucked into his left coat pocket, wearing what appears to be an off-white, almost pink shirt with a dark blue tie with pink dots. His hands are clasped along his lap, and he has short gray hair trimmed very neatly. And his eyes, again in this light, appear to be grayish. He's not smiling, but he's not frowning. He has a rather neutral visage. Chuck Schumer's flip phone has a two-tone ring. Buzz, 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 buzz. Two low tones, two high tones. So it would be buzz, 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 buzz. The Senate Majority Leader almost always knows who's calling, even though he does not program the numbers in. "Elizabeth, I'll call you back," he says, flipping the phone open in the middle of a recent interview in his office off the floor of the chamber. "Where are you? You're here? Okay, I'll call you back." He sees he's missed a call from a restricted number. "I know who's restricted. It's probably Warner," he says. He punches in the 10 digits for Virginia Senator Mark Warner, which he's memorized along with all the others. Did you just call me? Sure enough, that's who it was. It's an old Schumer party trick. Montana Senator John Tester, he says, just got a new number, and now I have it stuck in my head. For Schumer, that's S-C-H-U-M-E-R, the Senate's great kibitzer, leadership consists of talking and talking and talking and talking. The other 49 members of the Democratic caucus marvel at how frequently he calls. He calls just to check in. He calls in the middle of the night. He calls when other people might send a text or email. Formats he abhors. You never learn things by email. I hate it. Schumer estimates he talks to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi 2 or 3 times a day. President Biden 2 or 3 times a week. White House Chief of Staff Ron Klain 3 or 4 times a day. I talk to people. Talk, he says, feet propped on an ottoman to salve his bad knees. Everyone should talk. If you disagree with someone, fine. Be respectful. But talk. After 4 decades in Washington, Schumer is such a fixture it's easy to forget he's new at his current job. He only became majority leader in January. But faced with a massive task and with no votes to spare, he's hit his marks thus far, steering President Biden's agenda through the Senate with remarkable success. Biden's American Rescue Plan passed on a party line vote at its full proposed price tag, $1.9 trillion, in March. All but one of his original cabinet nominees were confirmed. Bills to fund technological research and crack down on hate crimes against Asian Americans have sailed through by wide bipartisan margins. And in the wee hours of the morning of August 11, the Senate passed a $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill, a priority that had eluded multiple previous presidents. None of this was inevitable. The Senate in recent years has been known more as a legislative bottleneck than as a fount of achievement. The body politic has rarely been more contentious. Everything from face masks to counting electoral votes devolves into partisan conflict. Nor was it clear at the outset that Schumer was up to the job. More at home at a press conference than a late-night bill markup, he built his reputation as a political guru, not a legislative strategist. Early on, some senators privately wondered if the people-pleaser would be able to instill discipline in his ideologically diverse ranks. Pessimists expected a return to the miserable grind of grandstanding speeches and blocked votes, yet the very qualities that inspired such skepticism, the frenetic schmooziness, the relentless politicking, may have made Schumer the man for the moment. Legislating, after all, is a collaborative effort. The representatives of America's far-flung component parts trying to find enough in common to make the laws for all of us. Schumer's garrulous style, a marked contrast to his Republican counterpart, the taciturn Mitch McConnell, as well as his Democratic predecessor, the laconic Harry Reid, makes every lawmaker feel essential and thus willing to be part of the solution. He sort of understands everyone's idiosyncrasies, from Bernie Sanders to Joe Manchin, says Senator Cory Booker, a New Jersey Democrat. He's touchy-feely. He wants to know how you're doing. He wants to understand your priorities, and that creates trust. Even if you don't get your way, you feel heard. Schumer's next act will be his biggest massive test yet, a massive $3.5 trillion grab bag of social spending Biden hopes will serve as the capstone of his ambitious domestic agenda. With no Republicans expected to support it, Schumer will have to get every member of his caucus on board. If he succeeds, Democrats believe they will have remade the social contract in ways not seen since FDR. The list of things we want to do, any one of them would be a major legislative achievement in a normal year, says Warner. listing child care subsidies, free community college, Medicare benefit expansion, climate proposals. I cannot think of a better time to have a debate about the role of government than now when we're coming out of COVID. To Schumer, the goal's bigger than making the Senate a pleasant place to work, making sure his party's president succeeds, or even making critical policies. It is about restoring Americans' faith in government in order to prevent the rise of another Donald Trump-style demagogue. Congress's reputation for ineptitude is not something Chuck Schumer can overcome in 2 years, says Karen Street, a former top Reid aide. But what he has accomplished thus far has built people's confidence about the ability to get something done across party lines, which is what this country needs right now. The day Schumer became majority leader was his worst day in the Senate. It was January 6, 2021. That morning, Democrats learned they had won a 50th Senate seat. And that afternoon, the Capitol was sacked by a mob dispatched by the still-sitting president, who could not accept he lost. Whisked away to an undisclosed location until the threat passed, Schumer later learned the rioters had come within yards of his path. It was not much of a leap to believe the insurrection had set the tone for 2 years of congressional warfare. Lawmakers' first task would be a second impeachment, further inflaming tensions. Democrats braced for a replay of the Obama years when the Republicans, led by McConnell, systematically obstructed the president's agenda, slow-rolling negotiations, weaponizing the 60-vote filibuster threshold, and refusing to give Obama's last Supreme Court nominee a hearing. The chamber struggled even to pass routine government funding legislation. When Biden, a 36-year Senate veteran, campaigned for president on a promise of bringing back bipartisan compromise, his Democratic primary competitors mocked his naivete. The current Senate's first order of business, Biden's American Rescue Plan, was styled as an economic stimulus and COVID-19 relief bill. But the funding for vaccines and $1,400 checks it contained was just the beginning of a laundry list of liberal spending, from paid leave to food stamp and health care subsidies. Many observers assumed the $1.9 trillion price tag was a negotiating gambit that would inevitably get whittled down. A group of Republicans made a counterproposal, hoping to start talks, but Schumer pressed the White House to pass the full proposal without delay on a party-line vote, and he bent over backward to get every Democratic senator to go along. At the last minute, it nearly fell apart when Manchin, the most conservative Democrat, objected to an unemployment insurance provision. Schumer spent 9 hours in frantic shuttle diplomacy with Manchin, the White House, and other members of the caucus. When the bill finally passed, it was a testament to his determination to accommodate his members. It was also a crucial show of strength, proving to Republicans that Democrats were willing and able to move on party lines when necessary. I think it's important to do everything we can to reach out to Republicans and do what we can get done on a bipartisan basis, says Senator Debbie Stabenow of Michigan. But I also know we need to get things done, and if Republicans are not willing to support us, we've shown we're willing to proceed as Democrats. Schumer, she says, is somebody who just doesn't quit. He'll talk to anybody anytime and just keep talking until they either give up or we get consensus. The early victory created momentum for other bipartisan efforts. Schumer ushered through a research funding package intended to counter Chinese influence as well as an anti-Asian hate crime bill, both by large margins, but the infrastructure package would be the main event of the legislative year, central to Biden's promise of practical pocketbook results. The president wanted it to be bipartisan, but Republicans balked. Biden's priorities included not just the traditional hard infrastructure of roads and bridges, pipes and power grids, but also huge social spending, which the administration called human infrastructure, and tax hikes on businesses and high earners. Weeks of negotiations between the White House and a group of GOP senators led by Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia went nowhere. By June, they had run aground. But a second bipartisan group had formed under the radar, led by Republican Rob Portman and Democrat Kyrsten Sinema, and that's spelled S-I-N-E-M-A. And they told Schumer they were making real progress. Their bill would be limited to hard infrastructure and be paid for without tax hikes. In consultation with Pelosi and Biden, Schumer devised a two-track process that would pair their bipartisan proposal with a second larger Democrats-only package containing other priorities. The complicated process is not necessarily what Schumer or many liberals preferred, but enough senators wanted it that he had little choice. There are a good number of my members who want to try to do things that are bipartisan, and I respect that, he said. But there are a lot of things you cannot do bipartisan. You cannot do climate. You cannot do the family stuff. You cannot do the kind of big, bold agenda we need. So we have two tracks, and each side knows they need the other. The moderates know they need the progressives to get their bill through, and the progressives know they need the moderates to get their proposal through. Now here's another photo, and in this photo, the room is better lit, and Mr. Schumer is standing on a figured carpet with his suit coat in his hands, and the room here looks like it's in kind of a buffed gold color. The big dark wood desk is still there. Other dark furniture in dark browns and possibly black. Dark wood double door leading out of the office, perhaps. And behind Mr. Schumer is a window shedding light into the office. Seated on the sofa, which is either dark brown or black, is a black suit clad man. It's Schumer with Raphael Warnock of Georgia, whose runoff win in January lifted the party to the Senate majority. Now, I'm going to skip ahead in this quite lengthy article to somewhere on the second third of the last page. If Schumer has been more successful than many anticipated, many factors have been working in his favor. Most new presidents get their top agenda items passed in the first 2 years of their term. Trump's exit prompted a sigh of relief on both sides of the aisle, while Democrats' hair's breadth margins have increased their sense of urgency not to let a minute in the majority go to waste. The 50-50 Senate may be as much a help as a hindrance. Most of the time, no one senator wants to be the one to blow things up for everyone else. And while the Senate may be less dysfunctional than before, it would be premature to declare that a grand new era of bipartisanship has dawned. Once promising police reform talks have stalled, voting rights legislation has run aground. Most Democrats see little hope for action on immigration or gun control. Even the two-track infrastructure and budget plan could still fall apart. House members, resentful of being locked out of the Senate talks, are itching to put their own stamp on both bills. The Senate approved the framework for the $3.5 trillion spending plan, but it has not yet been fleshed out in actual legislation. Those negotiations, now underway in various committees, promise to be at least as contentious and exhausting as the round just completed, and that bill, too, will have to get through the House. But success begets success, and the fact that the agenda has gotten this far has increased Democrats' confidence. There's going to be negotiations within our party, and that's fine, says Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, a member of Schumer's leadership team. But we are all committed to getting something done. We would not have been voting until 4 a.m. if we were not committed. And so Schumer keeps wearing out his flip phones. I bought 20 of them. I'm on number 18. He says gleefully, brandishing a since-discontinued 4-year-old LG, its 3-inch rectangular screen blessedly free of apps or widgets. What tends to break, he says, is not the electronics. It's the hinge in the middle, the connection between the parts. I try to set a direction, but only communicating. I do not just sit in a room, he says. You've got to listen to people, then decide the direction forward and explain it to them. And so far, everybody's followed. This article, which I did abridge, was written by Molly Ball, with reporting by Mariah Espada, Nick Popley, and Julia Zorthian. I'm turning now to a couple of pages that Time has dedicated to educators. Mostly I've chosen these because I like the pictures accompanying them. It was quite random selection otherwise. Starting here with Jennifer DeVosto, a small inset photo of a smiling young woman. We see her hair is long and flowing over her shoulders. She's wearing glasses and smiling. Orchestra director, Doylestown, Pennsylvania. An orchestra relies on community, so how the heck could it be taught remotely? That was the question Jennifer DeVosto, orchestra director of Central Bucks High School East, asked herself at the start of the 2020-2021 school year as the pandemic moved classes online. First, DeVosto asked all 80 orchestra students, ages 15 to 18, to rehearse with their cameras on so she could correct their posture and to send her recordings of themselves playing. She could feel them getting discouraged as they listened to their mistakes over and over again. But DeVosto, 38, was determined to give the kids a sense of success. So she asked a student who loved filmmaking if he could help her make a music video in lieu of the orchestra's usual fall concert. He agreed and used a drone to film students socially distanced on the school football field playing their instruments. DeVosto mixed the pre-recorded audio. The result was a hit with the students, who did additional videos for their holiday and springtime concerts. I've been teaching for 16 years, and this is by far the hardest year of teaching, says DeVosto, who has since transferred to a different school. It was all about celebrating the successes we did have, because that's what keeps you pushing through, and the kids are what brings the joy. That's why we got into this in the first place. Henry Darby, principal, North Charleston, South Carolina. This guy standing outside the, what does it say, North Charleston High School. It's a brick building. He's smiling broadly. He's wearing a short-sleeved white shirt and a gray and yellow tie and khaki pants. He's got a lot of keys hanging on a keychain attached to his belt. He's got some kind of photo ID in a pocket thing around his neck. He's got short gray hair and gray facial hair, and he's wearing glasses, and he's just smiling. Henry Darby did not sleep much during the past school year. For months, he finished his full-time job as a high school principal in North Charleston, South Carolina, worked overnight stocking shelves at Walmart, then went right back to North Charleston High School to oversee another day of pandemic learning. Darby did not need the extra money for himself. He donated earnings from his second job, which he had taken as he saw the financial hardship arising from COVID-19, back to his school community. Helping students and their families buy groceries, make mortgage payments, cover funeral costs. His school has a high poverty rate and all students qualify for free meals, but the need went well beyond that. Before taking the Walmart job, Darby had begun dipping into his personal emergency savings to help out. I just could not tell parents and students no. particularly when I knew they were in need, says Darby, 66. So the logical next thing for me to do was get another job. From August 2020 till April 2021, Darby worked at Walmart 3 days a week, stocking shelves from 10 p.m. to 7 a.m., arriving at school by 7:45 a.m. I basically slept on the weekends, he says. There were times that I just could not afford a nap or sleep. His work earned him the Order of the Palmetto, the state's highest civilian honor. People helped me as a young child when I needed them most, says Darby, whose father, mother, and grandmother all died before he turned 18. People really looked out to help me. As students at his school dealt with illness, unemployment, and grief, Darby has continued to look out for them. Mark Estrada, Superintendent Lockhart, Texas, another smiling face out of a small inset photo. This man has dark hair combed well back from his face, dark eyes, white shirt and tie. Superintendent Lockhart, Texas. When schools shut their doors in March 2020, leaving students with no option but remote learning, about 40% of families in the Lockhart Independent School District lacked home internet access. Many lived in dead zones in their rural area. Even if their families could afford it, it does not exist. If you give them a hotspot, they're just paperweights out there, says Mark Estrada, the district's superintendent. The district worked with Particle Communications, a Texas-based internet provider, spent about $650,000 to build 5 wireless internet towers in the district, most of which was later reimbursed by federal CARES Act funding. That enabled 1,600 students to get online at home, including some who used hotspots. I knew we were doing the right thing by making this investment because so many kids are able to be at home and get the internet that they need without having to work so hard to try to find somewhere to get connected, says Estrada, 39. When I got to the district 10 years ago, we didn't even have Wi-Fi in the building. So we've gone from not having Wi-Fi in our school classrooms to having it in living rooms across the community. Now, the next photograph is big. This looks like it's inside a big bus barn. It's a big metal building with beige walls and kind of a white insulation-like ceiling with skylights and commercial lighting hanging from the ceiling. Well, there's a concrete floor level. And there's a big yellow school bus inside. And what is readable on the side of the bus is Independent Schools, number 20. Well, standing in front of it are 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16 people. They're all dressed in various shades of pants, black and blue and khaki and beige and gray and other colors, too, I'm sure. And they've all got blue shirts on, and I cannot read what the shirts say. There's an indicia on it, and it looks like a ram emblem on the front of the shirt. And some of these people are wearing sunglasses, and some are wearing regular glasses, and some are wearing no glasses, and some are smiling, and some are not. And this article is entitled, A School Pony Express. School bus drivers, Cuba, New Mexico. Some call them a modern-day Pony Express. Others call them rock stars. To students throughout New Mexico's Cuba Independent School District, they're school bus drivers who were a lifeline during months of social distancing and remote learning. We were their links to school for a while. Other than seeing the teacher on Zoom, they would see us in person, says Ubaldo Kelly Maestas, 50. Really, the only contact they had with school was us, the bus drivers. The Cuba district serves a vast rural area about 80 miles north of Albuquerque. Most students are part of the Navajo Nation, and some live as far as 55 miles from school. For the district's 13 bus drivers, who can cover more than 300 miles in a day, work sometimes begins as early as 4 a.m. As remote learning took hold, they drove their usual routes, but instead of picking up kids, they delivered food, water, schoolwork, clothing, cleaning supplies. In return, they picked up students' finished homework or broken laptops and brought them back to school. "We are tired and exhausted," says Tammy Atencio, 37, who's Navajo, and grew up in the area of her bus route. But she says it was rewarding to know she was helping students keep learning. Whatever they are going through, they can depend on you to bring their schoolwork and bring food. In addition to the roughly 700 students in the Cuba district, for several months the drivers also brought meals to about 400 students outside the district who live in the community but were not receiving food from their schools. They were really able to put the whole entire school district on their back and make remote learning possible, says Victoria Dominguez, 31, a district social worker. Although they had all these tasks, they never batted an eye. It was sometimes confusing for young students. The kids were always asking me, "When are you going to start picking us up to go to school?" says Larry Sabata, who missed joking around with kids and offering them snacks on long bus rides. When some students returned for face-to-face learning, the drivers picked those students up for school in the morning, then went back out to deliver lunch to kids still learning remotely. Later, they'd return to school for the in-person learners and take them home at the end of the day. Us drivers joke that we're Uber Eats, we're FedEx, we're medical attention. We have to take kids' temperatures every morning, says Sabata, 61. We put on a lot of hats. Anna Phelan, P-H-E-L-A-N, first grade teacher, Philadelphia. Here she is wearing a mask, a young woman with long dark hair. She's teaching something. She's got her hands in the air as if she's explaining something. There are bright posters behind her, and she's seated at a table full of, coffee cups and laptops and water containers and paperwork. And she's a first grade teacher in Philadelphia. Kindergarten graduation is typically Anna Phelan's favorite day of the year. When COVID-19 ruined her plans for a typical celebration in spring 2020, she dropped off T-shirts, fabric markers, kid-sized graduation caps to each of her kindergartners and held socially distant celebrations for them at school, one at a time. When she realized her students at Overbrook Educational Center in Philadelphia would begin first grade virtually in the fall of 2020, Phelan volunteered to move up a grade to give the children a bit of consistency. As she saw that virtual learning was not serving many of her students, she compiled binders of everything they needed for upcoming lessons, index cards of words they were learning, writing, math worksheets, art supplies, and delivered them to parents every 2 weeks. She met them at school, outside their homes and jobs, even at gas stations. Phelan, 29, heard from parents who were grateful when she paid special attention to students struggling to learn remotely, who texted her when the child's reading improved, and who thanked her for sending home school supplies. "I committed to teach these kids in any way possible," she says. "If I have to be creative, that's fine. If I have to be driving around the city, that's fine. But my kids are going to learn." One more here. Andrew Williams, woodshop teacher, Gilroy, California. This man looks medium-aged with graying hair, a graying beard, sunglasses, smiling into the camera. Andrew Williams had a front row seat to the trials of teaching young learners virtually as he overheard his wife, a second grade teacher, begging students to pay attention and put the dog down, and noticed how many children were working from one crowded kitchen table with their siblings. "I thought, we're not going to learn this way. We're going to be like this for a year," says Williams, a woodshop teacher at Christopher High School, about 80 miles south of San Francisco. "I've got to help out and do something." He started by building a desk for one of his wife's students, then heard from other families who could not find desks for their children, so he made 50 more and gave them away to those in need. They went like hotcakes, says Williams, 56. I was buying material and building them as fast as I could. Williams could not teach his own students typical woodshop lessons during remote learning. For a teacher accustomed to hands-on work, the desks became a valuable outlet. I was able to save a little sanity myself by staying busy, he says. It was really bothering me sitting behind a computer 6 hours a day. I am not that kind of guy. Very briefly, for a minute, visiting 8 questions, Bill T. Jones, the 69-year-old choreographer and artistic director on Performing Again, Moby Dick, Why He Does Not Call His Work Dance. By Belinda Luscombe. Question, what would the 70-year-old version of you tell the 20-year-old? Answer, first, the world does not care if you want to be an artist. You will always be full of doubt. You will very likely never make a satisfying living. You may get hurt. And yet, it's exhilarating. When it works, when you're firing on all cylinders and there's a population that's leaning in to see, that can be rewarding in a way you can't imagine. Question, do you mourn the ability to dance as you used to? Answer, I do sometimes wish I had that motor I used to have. The impulse to move, the will to move, the ability to move are all one when you're young. Now, it has to be more thought out, which is its own kind of goal. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.